Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to a new season of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm Nicole DiMartino, your host. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. Tonight, as always, I am here with Jim Lang, CPA and attorney. Jim is a nationally acclaimed IRA and Roth IRA expert based right here in Pittsburgh, and he's also the best-selling author of the first and second edition of Retire Secure. And just out last November, November of 2010, the Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. Well, this is our first show of the year, and we are live tonight. The studio line number is 412-333-9385. Again, that's 412-333-9385. This is a great night to call because we have Bruce Steiner on our show tonight. We're going to be covering several topics, all surrounding the new estate and income tax law just passed at the end of 2010. So very timely, very valuable. So definitely stay tuned because this law will most likely affect you, and you need to know how to respond to it. Again, studio line 412-333-9385. Before Jim and Bruce get started, let's give Bruce an introduction here. Our guest tonight, Bruce Steiner. Bruce, are you there?
Yes.
All right. Well, welcome. How are you this evening?
Good.
Bruce is a New York City-based attorney who has over 30 years of experience in the areas of taxation, estate planning, business succession planning, and estate and trust administration. He is a much sought-after lecturer and author and has been quoted in Forbes, the New York Times, Financial Planning, Kiplinger's, and the New York Post, and that's just to name a few. We will also want to mention and congratulate Bruce for being named a New York Super Lawyer in 2010. And if you want the full scoop on Bruce, you can visit his LinkedIn profile, and then you can read his whole bio, see all of his articles, see where he's published, and you can click on the links and take a look at those articles. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim.
And before we get into it, I just want to say that I've been a great fan of particularly Bruce's articles and the things that he writes. He has wonderful content and is a good writer, and I was just thrilled that you were able to make it and you've agreed to do this show tonight. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Bruce, there's a lot of estate attorneys who are talking about the new tax act, the Tax Relief Act of 2010, as a brand new ball game with the new provisions. Could you tell our listeners what you think are the most important changes in the act and how you think that some of these changes will impact most of our listeners tonight?
Well, that's a broad question.
If you want me to narrow it down a little bit, how about let's just break it down. Mm-hmm. Say what you think are some of the most important provisions of the new tax relief of 2010 as it applies to estate planning.
Okay, on the estate tax side, we have the estate tax has returned except with a $5 million exempt amount for 2 years, for 2011 and 2012, and then it reverts to $1 million in 2013. The gift tax, which had been a $1 million exempt amount for many years, is now unified with the estate tax, so it's a $5 million exempt amount for 2011 and 2012, and then it's scheduled to revert to $1 million in 2013. The generation skipping transfer tax is likewise $5 million exempt amount for 2011 and 2012, and then it reverts to $1 million in 2013. The tax rate, the gift tax was 35% last year, and for the next 2 years, for 2011 and 2012, the estate tax, the gift tax, and the GST tax rate are all at 35%, and they're scheduled to revert to 55% in 2013. So you have a 2-year window mm-hmm. for taking advantage of the lower tax rate and the higher exempt amount.
All right. I think that's great. C- Could you tell our listeners what you mean by the exempt amount, in case there's some people who are a little bit unclear as to what the exempt amount means, and what happens if you
sure.
die with a certain amount of money, either less than, equal to, or more than the exempt amount?
Sure. Let's say you die and you have $10 million, and the exempt amount this year is $5 million. So ignoring some of the little nuances and complexities, $5 million is exempt, and the next $5 million is subject to tax at 35%. If you make gifts during your lifetime, that counts against your estate tax exempt amount. So if I, during my lifetime, let's say today I gave away $2 million to somebody, I didn't pay any gift tax because I had a $5 million gift tax exempt amount, but I used up $2 million of what would be my estate tax exempt amount. It's the same exempt amount. I don't get to use it twice. So when I die, I only have $3 million of it left.
All right, that is good. I think that really helps people. Now, you say that there is now a $5 million exempt amount, but what if you're married? Are you allowed to exempt $5 million each, or is it $10 million now? All right, and
well, it's a little of each of those things, Jim. For gift tax, there has always been the ability to treat gifts as if they were made half by each spouse, so that if today you were married and you gave your child $10 million, you and your spouse could agree to treat that gift as if you each made $5 million of it and thereby not pay any gift tax. And when you die, there's no tax on anything that you leave to your spouse. So if you died worth $10 million and you had a spouse, and you, to take a simple case, left $5 million to your child and $5 million to your spouse, you'd pay no estate tax. The $5 million to your child is exempt because it's a $5 million exemption, and the $5 million to your spouse is not taxed because it went to your spouse. And for the next 2 years, there's something called portability that says that if you leave it all to your spouse inherits your exempt amount, your $5 million exempt amount that you didn't use because you left everything to your spouse where it wasn't taxed because it went to your spouse. Your estate can then agree to give your spouse your $5 million exemption that you didn't use, and then she'll have $10 million of exemption, and this is for 2 years only. It's a little bit like the 2001 law, where the provisions of the law ended at some point. So the 2010 law, its provisions only go for another 2 years, and then they're scheduled to end, and Congress in 2012, maybe they'll have another lame duck session at the end of the year and extend it or make it permanent or you know, no one knows what they'll do.
Well, whether you like it or not, at least they got it done. We actually have a question on this exact issue from Pete in actually Putnam County, New York. Pete, are you on the line? Pete, are you here? Okay, Pete, we're gonna cut you off in a minute. All right, Pete, you're cut off. You lost it. sorry about that. He actually had a question, and it was right on point too, or at least the little note that we had. But anyway, Bruce, one of the things that you were talking about, well, if you have $5 million, if you have $10 million, and then you continued, and everything that you said was right and accurate and well expressed. But what happens if you don't have $5 or $10 million? Let's say that you're in Pittsburgh and you're not broke, but maybe you have a half a million or a million or 2 million or even 3 million. What kind of advice would you be giving to somebody who maybe has existing wills and trusts, etc., and doesn't have $5 or $10 million, and presumably they would not be subject to estate tax, but of course, there's uncertainty. What advice would you have for people that have less than $5 and $10 million in terms
That's
of what
harder.
They should be doing?
Those are harder, Jim, because if the 2010 law expires in 2 years and the estate tax exempt amount reverts to $1 million, then the spouse's estate is likely to pay estate tax. So it's hard to know what to do. Let's say if you had $3 million and your spouse had let's say nothing to make it simple. If the exempt amount stays at $5 million, you could leave it all to your spouse, pay no estate tax, and then the spouse's estate is less than $5 million, and the spouse wouldn't pay estate tax either.
After the spouse dies.
Right.
Right.
But if the exemption drops down to $1 million, and you could have left your $3 million in a way that wouldn't be subject to estate tax. Oh, there's portability right now, but that expires in 2 years also. So we can't be sure that if you died today, that if your spouse lives until 2013, we're not sure the portability is still there.
Well, let me ask you this. You said it's a tough one. I have, you know, well, you probably know how I would handle that. But before we get into that,
I certainly do.
All right, and it's perfectly fine for us to disagree. You know, it really is. What would you do? Let me give you two situations. One, let's say that you have an existing client, and you have done their will. And let's just say, for discussion's sake, that you have done a traditional AB will, because I know that maybe you do some variation of that, but I know that is a portion of your practice. Are you planning to alert people and say, hey, it's time to consider changing your will? And B, how would you handle that if there was a new client that came to your office, or is it always going to be a case-by-case basis?
I think it's a little bit of a case-by-case basis because there are so many considerations. There's state estate taxes in New York. In Pennsylvania, you've got your state inheritance tax, and about half the states have a state estate or inheritance tax, and about half don't. There's creditors and protection against remarriages and Medicaid and all sorts of other things besides taxes. So it's not that easy to have a blanket answer. Some people would say, let me take my $3 million and leave it to what you call the B trust. That's a trust that's set up to be not included in the spouse's estate, but available to the spouse in case she needs it. And that means that at the first death, you may or may not pay some state taxes in New York, where the exempt amount is $1 million, you'd pay a couple $100,000 to do that. In Pennsylvania, your exempt amount, I understand, for the state level is zero.
Zippo.
So
the first dollar, the governor gets some money.
You'd pay $100,000+ to do that, but you'd be sure that it would be protected against being included in the spouse's estate. You'd be pretty sure it would be protected against the spouse's creditors. You'd be pretty sure it would be protected if the spouse remarried, and you have a pretty good chance it's protected if the spouse goes into a nursing home and wants Medicaid. On the other hand, if this were, let's say, New York, where you had a New York exempt amount of $1 million, you'd be paying estate tax to New York on the excess $2 million, whereas if you, for example, only sheltered, say, $1 million, and then let the other $2 million go to the spouse, you'd save some New York tax. And if the spouse moved to a state like Florida that didn't have a state tax, you'd you'd save state income tax on all of it. So some people might only shelter the amount that's free of not only federal but state estate tax, and if in Pennsylvania that means you wouldn't shelter anything if that were your your goal. So it's a sort of a choice. It's hard to know for sure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Sorry, Bruce. We'll be right back with the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back. We're here with Jim Lang and Bruce Steiner, and we're talking about the new estate tax law.
Anyway, Bruce, you were starting to talk about some of the issues with the B trust, and what the best course of them to do is, and I'm going to add in a few other wrinkles that I think are very important in real life, and that is uncertainty. We have so much uncertainty that we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we're going to die in this two-year period. We don't know what's going to happen after the two-year period. We don't know how much money is going to be in the estate. We don't know what the market's going to be. We don't know the needs of the surviving spouse. We don't know the needs of the kids or even the needs of the grandchildren. There's so much that we don't know. And I was curious how you handle that. And I am going to give the listeners a little idea of how I handled it, and then I'm going to ask what your opinion of that is. And you have license to not agree with me. But out of curiosity, how have you traditionally handled that problem, the problem of uncertainty? And now I would say that uncertainty is exacerbated these days because you have uncertainty in the estate tax laws. In fact, we're relatively certain that something is going to happen in 2 years, not to mention, again, uncertainty of the market and the needs of the survivors. How have you handled uncertainty in the past? And what is your plan to handle it in the future?
Well, I think that the thing that we have to pay more attention to, in addition to how much goes into the credit shelter trust, but what are the terms of the credit shelter trust? In other words, if the credit shelter trust is sufficiently flexible, if it allows the trustees to distribute income and principal to the spouse or the children or the grandchildren, or accumulate the income depending on what seems best from time to time, and if it's appropriate, the spouse has the power to, what we call a power of appointment, the power to essentially make gifts out of the trust either to the children or grandchildren or maybe even to anybody she wants. And maybe the spouse should be a trustee, and maybe the spouse should even have the power to remove and replace her co-trustee. So if you may want to give more thought to just how flexible you want to make the trust and how much control do you want to give the spouse over the trust. And if you do all those things, then how much goes into the trust is more of just a tax question, balancing the tax benefits and detriments.
I actually think that's a very good idea. Quick technical, I'll tell you my approach, which is a little different, but a quick technical question about that. It sounds like what you want to do is have very, very flexible provisions on what is in that B trust. And I conceptually agree with you. But typically, I find that the spouse themselves wants to be the trustee of their own trust. Do you have a technical problem if you have very flexible and loose provisions in the trust and name the spouse as the trustee?
Well, she can be a trustee. And she can have the power to remove and replace her co-trustee.
All right. So when you say a trustee, that's not the trustee. That's one of two or more trustees. Is that right?
One of two or more trustees, but she can have the power to remove and replace her co-trustee, provided the replacement trustee is not either a close relative or a subordinate employee if she is employed somewhere. That still leaves a few hundred million people she can pick as a, as a replacement trustee. And if I'm the co-trustee and I don't do what she wants and she can fire me, I'm probably going to pay some attention to what she wants.
I actually think that's a good answer. As you might know, I have a slightly different approach, and what I'd like to do is spend a few minutes telling the listeners what my approach might be, and then again, I'm going to ask you to feel free to disagree with me or tell me if you like or don't like or like some of what my approach is. My approach is to something like this is I think there's so much uncertainty, and I'm going to make a very important assumption for this approach that I'm about to describe, and that is that you are talking about a traditional couple, a traditional married couple. I call it the Leave It to Beaver couple, the original husband, the original wife, and the same kids, not kids from his marriage or kids from her marriage, but kids from our marriage. And let's assume people have been married 30, 40 years or just a long time, and they trust each other. And in fact, I always even asked, do you trust your spouse? And I sometimes get a joke, but let's assume the answer is yes. Since to me, the four basic choices are, so let's say you have this traditional family. You have husband, wife, children, grandchildren, and they're the same kids from each, that is, they have the same parents and they have the same grandparents. If the four basic, and first of all, let me ask you a question. Are the four basic choices, in your opinion, the surviving spouse, the B trust that we have talked about with, which you're saying should have flexible provisions, which I would agree with you, kids equally, or well-drafted trust for the benefit of grandchildren, particularly if they're minors? Would you say that those are the four basic choices?
Okay.
All right. So let's say that those are the four basic choices, and what I'm saying is, since I don't know what the needs of the spouse are going to be, I don't know what the exemption amount's going to be, I don't know what the investments are going to be, and I have found, and you may or may not have found the same thing, that clients today are more interested in providing for each other and making sure that they never run out of money. And after the husband dies, his concern is, I want to make sure my wife has enough money to live comfortably, do whatever she wants for the rest of her life. I'm getting more and more of that, and less of trying to save taxes. Now with $5 million exemption, taxes become even more remote. The way I would approach something like that is, rather than deciding today and locking in stone who gets what, so much money goes to the spouse, so much money goes to the B trust, so much money goes to kids equally, so much money goes to grandchildren, and not just money, but we haven't brought in the issue of the different types of assets like IRAs, retirement plans, 401ks, 403bs, Roth IRAs, Roth 401ks, etc. You have all these different assets. My approach to this for the traditional married couple, not always, but I would say the vast majority of the time, might be to, rather than decide today who gets what, create wills and trusts and beneficiary designations, etc., that will give the surviving spouse the power to decide, not today, but within 9 months after the first death. And in 9 months, we're going to know more. We're going to know what the federal estate tax law is after the first death. We're going to know what the portfolio is. We're going to know what the need, well, maybe not perfectly, but we'll have a better idea of the needs of the surviving spouse and the children and the grandchildren. So I tend to prefer a very flexible plan. And as you probably know, I made some hay writing about it in many, many sources. And I was curious as to what you think of the flexible plan. I'll also mention that another New York estate attorney is not necessarily a huge fan of it. But I thought I would ask you and see what you think of this flexible plan for the couple that I have described. And I would say that there would be a fairly wide variation in terms of the people I would use it for, in terms of how much money they had. That is, if they only had $1 million, we might not need the Bee Trust at all. But I'm not sure that there'd be any harm in leaving that as an option. So again, I'm curious, how would you?
Well, let's put aside the retirement benefits for a moment. Although I really want to come back to that, because for the modest estates, they're often the largest asset.
Right. That's most of my clients, by the way, people who are what I would call IRA or retirement plan heavy.
Sure. And I too, since I speak and write so much on retirement benefits, I see a lot of that as well. If it's someone in a state like Florida with no state income tax, I think I'd want to shelter the whole $5 million and give the spouse control over the credit shelter trust so that effectively, she controls it. If I'm in New York,
Time out. Let's even say you're in Florida. Doesn't the credit shelter trust say health, maintenance, and support? And what if the surviving spouse wants more than health, maintenance, and support? What if they want to go to Aruba?
Then, well, first of all, it's only after she's used up her own money does this become relevant.
Well, that's true.
But we're gonna see more and more of this because if we're sheltering $5 million, you know, we may have ended up with everything in the credit shelter trust, the very thing that you were concerned about.
That is my fear. My fear is we are going to restrict the surviving spouse, and I don't think that spouses want to be restricted.
But if you limit distributions to health, maintenance, and support, you set up a straw person here, because there's no reason to limit the things that you can make distributions for, and there's lots of other reasons not to limit distributions to health, maintenance, and support. So I don't recall having done that in, I don't know, many years.
But if you more or less let the spouse do whatever they want, which is what you're saying, is that trust not also subject to being challenged as being a sham and letting the surviving spouse do whatever they want?
It's not a sham at all. The spouse cannot vote to make distributions to herself. Only the other trustees can make distributions to the spouse.
Okay.
And if the spouse has the power to fire the co-trustee is going to be receptive to the spouse's request for distributions.
Okay.
If I'm in New York, I'm going to at least want to shelter $1 million, even if I'm not concerned about federal estate. Even if I don't think I'm concerned about federal estate tax, I'm going to want to shelter the million that's New York exempt. You're in Pennsylvania. You've got a zero Pennsylvania state estate tax amount.
That's right. But in the
smaller estates, you may want to give it all to the spouse and not pay Pennsylvania tax at the first death. You also have, if you do it via disclaimer and the spouse disclaims to get money into the credit shelter trust, let's say you've got $10 million and you leave it all to the spouse and she disclaims $5 million to fill up your credit shelter trust, you have a less flexible credit shelter trust, because if the trust gets money as a result of the spouse's disclaimer, she can't participate in discretionary distributions to other beneficiaries. She can't have a power of appointment in favor of the children and grandchildren. So you end up with her having less control than if the credit shelter trust got the money from the get-go.
Well,
so that's your trade-off.
Well, by the way, I think that was well spoken, because I think that is... That is one of the trade-offs or weaknesses of my very flexible plan, is that while the traditional documents are starting with the Bee Trust as the primary beneficiary, I'm saying no, I want the spouse to be the primary beneficiary. I want the Bee Trust to only come into existence if the spouse doesn't want or doesn't want a portion.
And you may do that more often in Pennsylvania, because to put even a penny into the credit shelter trust, you're paying Pennsylvania tax, which somebody might not want to. And the other thing, let's circle back to the retirement benefits.
I knew you were going to get there.
Well, I want to go there because...
Well, you're a national expert in the area, and it would be a shame to have you on and not hear your opinion on it.
I appreciate that. With the retirement benefits, I would absolutely do what you propose, because with the retirement benefits, even if it means not filling up your credit shelter trust, let's take the example of someone who has $3 million IRA and $3 million of other assets. So you've got a trade-off. If you fill up the credit shelter trust, in order to get $5 million in there, you've got three of other assets, and then you've got to use up two of the IRA to put into the credit shelter trust. And if you give the IRA all to the spouse, which has some income tax benefits that we'll get into in a minute, you're not filling up your credit shelter trust, because you gave the spouse the IRA for three and you only have three left for the credit shelter trust. You've got to choose your poison. You've got to choose one or the other. The income tax benefits of letting the spouse get the IRA are very substantial. She can roll it over into her own IRA. She can convert it to a Roth IRA, which has lots and lots of benefits, which I hope we'll have some time to talk about. She can name new beneficiaries. She can get a much longer stretch-out period for the distributions. And my experience has been that given a choice between the income tax benefits of taking the IRA and the estate tax benefits of filling up the credit shelter, that people more often choose to take the IRA. I have three estates right now where that's a factor, and in all three of them, I think they're going to take the IRA. In one, there's a possibility of a disclaimer of a very small sliver of it to fill up the state exempt amount, but I'm not even sure that that's going to happen, because again, the income tax benefit of taking the IRA and rolling it over, converting to a Roth and naming new beneficiaries, may well outweigh the possible estate tax benefit. And in the modest estates, there may not be any estate tax in the second estate. No one knows what the tax law will be down the road.
Well, we are in agreement on the beneficiary of the IRA and retirement plan in Pennsylvania.
That we would do in any state with the IRA. Your third tier, the children, we would have the children take in trust rather than outright.
Well, sure. It shouldn't go without saying, because we always do that.
Jim, I need
you
to pop
that.
In. We're a little over halfway through the show. We're talking with Jim Lang and Bruce Steiner. We are live, so if you want to give us a call, that number is 412-333-9385. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. We are here with Jim Lang and Bruce Steiner for the last segment of our show.
All right, very good. Bruce, we were talking about that we were in agreement on how to treat the IRA beneficiary and the retirement plan beneficiary and the Roth beneficiary. And I think really we're in agreement on most things. The only, I guess, difference that we would do is I would probably be willing to suffer a few limitations on the surviving spouse in favor of flexibility in terms of what she could do if the money went into the trust, in favor of giving her complete access to making her the primary beneficiary of not only the IRA, but also the after-tax dollars, and making the surviving spouse the boss. Is that a fair characterization of our disagreements, if you will?
I think disagreement is a little a little bit strong. I think
okay.
we've done it. We've done it in different ways, in different cases. And if you've got a cooperative co-trustee, there's possibilities for. I mean, the co-trustee can to get you to the desired result.
Well, I do see that, and I understand the practical implications of what you're suggesting. I'm also, frankly, taking into account the surviving spouse's psychological frame of mind.
I
just find that spouses don't want to be limited, and let's say that the total estate is $1 or $2 million or whatever it is. Right now, when the husband and wife are both alive, they each or together, they have access to 100% of the marital money. And I think that often the surviving spouse is not going to be happy if they don't have access to the marital money after the first death.
I think you're right. I think in the smaller ones like that, especially with portability, you don't even need portability. If the exempt amount stays high and it's we've all been wrong in predicting what Congress would have done last year, but so I hesitate to predict what they'll do 2 years from now. But if I can stick my head out on the limb, I can't see the exempt amount going back to $1 million 2 years from now after being $5 million for a couple of years. I think in the smaller ones, a lot of people will do just that, although there's a trade-off also if the spouse goes into a nursing home and wants Medicaid, and in the smaller estates, people might think that preserving the inheritance for the children might be worth something. But if that's not a concern, or if you're willing to trade that off, I think a lot of people will just simply let it go to the spouse.
All right. Well, that actually brings up another issue. Have you had any trouble in terms of what happens to these B trusts? Because I know sometimes lawyers love to set up different entities, whether it be B trusts or corporations or other things, and they draft these things. And then the client is done, and then somebody dies, or in the event of a corporation, people start doing business. And then it's the CPA who has to deal with the fallout. In other words, you know, the complications of the tax return, the complications of administering the trust, or in the event of incorporating, I sometimes prefer simple, just a plain old Schedule C, or leaving money to the trust. Have you had... let's say, problems in administrating the trust or...
In administering a credit shelter trust? Well, we've had our share of credit shelter trusts where no one has bothered to file income tax returns for the trust.
Ouch, that sounds painful.
I mean, if we're administering the estate, we'll coordinate with the accountant and just make sure that, you know, he or she understands what it is he or she is supposed to do in terms of fiduciary income tax returns. But we've had cases where people come to us later and there was a credit shelter trust in place for a while and sort of nobody bothered to file income tax returns. It's happened probably more than once.
Okay. I'll just bring that up as let's say one more reason why I like to sometimes keep things simple. And I know that One area that we're 100% agreement on is that we don't like these B trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs or retirement plans. There was an article in the Post Gazette, maybe about a year or two ago, when somebody was quoting one of the big bank trustees as saying the Q-tips were wonderful solutions for IRAs and retirement plans, and I wrote a letter to the editor and strenuously objected. I think
there are occasional solutions where the spouse is going to need a lot of money out of it anyway, so that you're not giving up that much stretch and where you absolutely don't want the spouse controlling it. But they're very, very occasional solutions. I can count on fingers of one hand the cases I've had where it made sense, although I'm doing one right now where it's going to be a Q-tip and then to charity, and seems to fit what the person wants, but it's an unusual one.
Well, Q-tip to charity is a slightly different issue. You know something? It was my goal tonight not to talk about Roth IRA conversions because we had talked about Roth IRA conversions quite a bit. But then when we were talking,
never talk about it enough.
When we were talking a little for a few minutes on the phone earlier today, and we were saying what we were going to talk about, the first thing you said is, well, we have to talk about Roth IRA conversions. So listeners, this is not prompted by me. This was really prompted by Bruce. So Bruce, I'm going to put the blame on your shoulders. But
I'll happily take it. I think
or the credit. So
the Roth has been around since 1998, I think, was the first year you could do a Roth conversion.
That's right. That's because my wife and I made a $250,000 conversion back then.
Wow.
Well, that was everything for us. We were in our early 40s.
Wow. And it still hasn't been very well understood, perhaps because last year was the very first year that you could convert even if your income was over $100,000. And I think most lawyers in our field spend most of our time dealing with clients with income over $100,000. And so it hasn't gotten as much attention as it should have. For most people, the decision is not whether to convert. The question is when to convert. In other words, do you convert all at once, or do you dribble the conversion out over time? And do you convert or begin to dribble out the conversion now, or do you wait until some future time? We had last year a number of clients who said that not only were they in the top tax bracket, but they expected that they would always be in the top tax bracket. So for them, it was a no-brainer. You convert it all at once.
And did you do a number of multi-million dollar conversions?
Yes.
Yeah, so did we. So did we. And I think that was the right thing. And are you planning on recognizing that income in 2010 or 2011 and 12?
That was interesting. At the time, we thought the rate would surely go up from 35 to 39.6, and so you'd pick up all the income in 2010 to have it at 35, but now maybe you do it half in 2011 and half in 2012, since it'll stay at 35.
Well, I'm smiling because I've independently come to the same conclusion. And what about, let's say, for what I would imagine a more typical listener who isn't in the top tax bracket and won't always be in the top tax bracket, but let's say is in the middle tax brackets, what would you say to them in terms of when, amount, and when to recognize?
Well, if you expect to be in the middle tax bracket sort of forever, and you converted a big IRA all at once, it would throw you into the top tax bracket all at once. And let's put numbers on it. The brackets are 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, 35, if I got them right.
Yeah, that's right.
So a middle tax bracket is 25.
Fair enough.
So if you're in the 25 and you convert, or worse yet, if you're in the 15 and you convert a very large IRA, now you're in the 35 in that 1 year. So you might be better off, you'd almost certainly be better off to dribble out the conversion a little bit each year to not put yourself into too high a bracket in 1 year. And we found the most typical is to convert up to the top of the 28 bracket. In other words, if you're in the 15 or the 25 or the 28 bracket, you might convert as much as you can without going past 28. I have one person who's in the 15% bracket and is very timid. He's converting every year the amount he can convert and still be in the 15 bracket. I think he's a little timid. I think he should go for 25 or 28. Because it's going to be hard to get that money out in the 15 bracket because it's too much money. But whatever, better what he's doing than nothing at all.
Yeah, and see, I frankly lean a little bit conservative also. So I'm typically, it also depends on how many years we have in the 15% bracket. If we have a lot of years,
Right. It depends. If you're working and earning a high income, but your income is going to drop off when you retire, maybe you wait and you begin the conversion when you retire.
Yeah,
or maybe after you're not around, your spouse begins the conversion. Whichever one of those happens first.
Right. Although sometimes, and I hate to be morbid about this, but sometimes in a terminal situation, we have been doing some deathbed Roth IRA conversions.
Do it all at once. I have that now. I have somebody who was, she's about 90 years old. I just got involved because a guardian got appointed for her because she couldn't handle her affairs anymore. And we just got her to, and she's got quite a bit of income anyway, and is, if not in the 35, is probably 28 or maybe 33, and we just had her convert her entire IRA last year for fear that if we spread it over a few years, she might not make it, and we were expecting to just pick up the income all in 2010. Now it may be half in 2011 and half in 2012. I think we're going to sort of wait until October 15th when we have to decide, and then decide at that point.
I like waiting, and that has the added benefit of helping the tax preparer spread out their season burden.
Jim, we're going to take one more break before the end of the show. You're listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. You're here with Jim Lang and Bruce Steiner, and I think we have a few minutes left, Jim. So what are you going to next?
Well, one thing I want to do before we do end the show is I want to tell our listeners how they could benefit from some of Bruce's information. And Bruce, when somebody says, "Hey, do you know a good attorney in New York City?" I mentioned your name. In fact, I mentioned your name today, and I want, if you could give our listeners contact information for you, mm-hmm. and I have enjoyed some of your articles, and particularly. One, something like the 10 worst mistakes that you can make. If you could tell people how they could get a hold of you and some of your information, I think that would benefit our listeners.
Mm-hmm. My phone number is 212-986-6000, and if you just Google me, you'll sort of find lots of things.
You're all over the place. You've written a lot of stuff for a lot of years.
Yeah, if you just Google my name, or maybe my name and the word attorney and the word New York or something, you'll come up with lots of things.
And again, by the way, that's Bruce Steiner.
Yes.
Thanks, Jim. back to where we were before the break. As I mentioned before, we always have our clients provide for their children in trust rather than outright, to keep it out of the children's estates and to protect against the children's creditors and predators and spouses.
Trust
get to that top 35% income tax bracket at about $11,000 or $12,000 of taxable income, and with other assets, you have some control over taxable income, but traditional IRA benefits come out and they're taxable. So the only way around that is to give up the benefit of the protection of the trust by distributing out the money. So there's a trade-off there. And the Roth conversion avoids that, because if you've converted to a Roth, the Roth distributions come out free of tax. So when you're comparing the tax rate on the conversion against the tax rate you'd otherwise pay when the money came out, the tax rate you'd otherwise pay when the money came out, if you want the protection of the trust, is likely to be 35%.
All right, so that's interesting. So let me clarify to see if this is what you're doing. Let's say you have a plain old IRA and not a Roth IRA. You would typically leave that to children, not in a trust, but outright, to avoid the acceleration of income and to avoid high income tax rates in the event that you wanted to accumulate. But if it was a Roth, you'd feel more comfortable in a trust.
Well, no, either way, we'd leave a regular IRA to children in a trust as well, but then is the trade-off that the trustee either keeps the money in the trust and pays tax probably at 35% or distributes the money that comes out each year to the children or grandchildren, saves some income tax, but give up the protection of the trust. So it's a trade-off.
Yeah, and I see that. And frankly, again, this might be one area that, and I, of course, it's always the client's decision, but when a client tells me, hey, they trust their kids and their kids are responsible and they're, you know, they don't have lots of creditors. And to me, the biggest creditor that I fear is their future ex-spouse. And I sometimes like to account for that with pre or post-nuptial agreements. I might be a little bit less trust-oriented than you. I know Natalie Schott in New York. She assumes nobody's going to disclaim anything, and she's very interested in having it pretty locked up, where I, on the other hand, tend to maybe have some more trusting clients, and I tend to give discretion to the surviving spouse, and then after the surviving spouse is gone, I tend to give some discretion to the children. But that might be a little difference that I might be a little bit more inclined to leave to children outright, although I would never do that to for young children or for spendthrifts or people with drug problems or alcohol problems, etc. But that was actually, and we're unfortunately not going to get to anywhere near of 10 of your biggest mistakes.
Nope.
you've just given us a lot of information, but one of the things that you did say, and one of my big things is, which was your number 9 in terms of mistakes, which was not considering a disclaimer. And I thought maybe if you could expand on that, and I'm going to even put it in two areas. One, while you are drafting the documents, that is, while everybody's still alive, and then two, after the first or second death. So if you could talk a little bit about what you have been doing about disclaimers, because as you know, I'm a huge fan of disclaimers, and I put in enormous flexibility both at the first death and the second death. And you know something, you're gonna have about 1 minute.
Yeah, you have about 30 seconds, Bruce.
Well, you have you have 9 months within which to disclaim, meaning refuse to accept something that someone gives or leaves to you. In which case it goes as if you had predeceased, unless the will provides some other alternate disposition. We probably do disclaimers in a third or half of the estates that we administer. Someone disclaims something. It's a very useful tool.
Alrighty, Bruce, thank you so much. This was Bruce Steiner. If you want more information on him, just Google him. He said everything, a ton pops up. It does do that. Jim, good night. Thank you very much. Great show. If you want more information on our workshop, January 29th, go to retiresecure.com. And again, listen every Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at retiresecure.com. To seek Jim's advice personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.